What Does Law Mean, Mumu? The podcast series. Hello, it's Pauline Marinan here, continuing on this podcast series, which is a discussion on an informal basis through the chapters of the little book that I wrote called What Does Law Mean, Mumu? Which is an introduction to the law for young people, not a comprehensive law book by any manner or means, never intended to be that in this format, although it was my original intention to do a full law book type presentation. I thought better of that and decided to bring to you a number of topics that arose as a result of a walk and talk, as I call it, with a group of young people, and the responses to those questions makes up the book as it's presented in a story format. In chapter 9, we discovered the background to the European Union. We discussed a little about that in the context of Brexit. The book was originally written in 2016 in outline format with a view to it being a law book. And then eventually I moderated it into the story format in 2018. And last year, 2019, I amended it slightly to bring it up to be more applicable to young adults, young people, rather than the younger age group. And at that time, particularly in 2019, the discussions about Brexit had been waging in the United Kingdom and had represented really the majority of the focus on the news every evening, as Parliament was put to the test and every process you can imagine was stretched to the limits. Just looking back and recapping in a way, after the two world wars that we've already discussed, the second ending in 1945, at the end of being ravaged, torn apart by these vicious wars, all the idealism of previous times had been abandoned or lost or threatened, people began to think that there could be close relationships throughout business and trade might keep people engaged with one another, recognising their differences, but also recognising what they had in common. And so they thought in those circumstances there would be less likelihood of conflict between them ever erupting again. And so initially it was known as the European Economic Community, later described more commonly as the Common Market. So the founding states that had decided to create this grouping were Germany, Italy, France, Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg. As time went on, the benefits of the cooperation were recognised as being substantial. And in the 1960s, the UK considered joining. At that time, Ireland was struggling economically, and it also considered the benefits. The results of this was that in 1973, Ireland, Denmark and the United Kingdom joined the European Economic Community, known for short as the EEC. A couple of years after that, they held a referendum in the United Kingdom and a substantial majority of people voted to stay in. But unfortunately, as the years progressed, more and more people in the United Kingdom were focusing on the negative sides of the arrangement, the project to some people. People who are not that happy with the arrangement tend to refer to it as the project and thought they were giving more than they were gaining. The result of that, in turn, was that in 2016, the British government held a referendum, out of which 51.89% of the people voted to leave. Now, within that vote, which is a slim majority nonetheless, Scotland had voted to remain and the north of Ireland had voted to remain. Wales had voted to leave with England. So the upshot was 51.89. Now, the results were very interesting because it exposed differences of opinion, different experiences from different parts of the country, but also different parts of England. For example, in London, the majority of people had voted to remain. So it was a tempestuous time, and there really wasn't much that could be done except that the negotiations to leave were to proceed along certain timelines. There was a prime minister in office then called Theresa May, who had to handle all of the diversity and difficulties and the discussions and debate after the prime minister, David Cameron, who had been in when the referendum was held, had resigned and Theresa May took over. I suppose one of the things that came out of this was that there hadn't really been a referendum for some time in the United Kingdom, and countries that use referendum tend to be countries with written constitutions, as we discussed in the last chapter. And it's an unusual, some people describe it as a blunt instrument, but it's a means of putting up usually a single issue. If, for example, a country is considering amending or deleting an article in their constitution, and it's used mainly on that premise that the question put to the people will require a yes or a no answer. And that's the way a referendum would proceed. Usually there is heavy emphasis before the referendum on the distribution of information about the implications and what's likely to occur if the vote goes one way or the other. And that's usually overseen by the referendum commission, usually headed up by a very senior judge, who would in the normal course come on national radio, the broadcasting corporations, to give advice about it and to answer questions put in from the public. There wasn't really very much evidence of that in the context of the referendum on Brexit, I must say. I wasn't aware of there being very much of, by way of public information or debate or discussion, about some of the implications of the leave and what that would bring about. Unfortunately, that did lead to a lot of debate, a lot of division, and the public really were quite dismayed when they discovered that, for example, the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Agreement, as it's sometimes called, which was the agreement after a very long process, a peace process to bring peace and tranquility in Northern Ireland, that the United Kingdom was a signatory with the Republic of Ireland of that agreement. And by Britain leaving the European Union, it would create a border on the island of Ireland, as it's described. And by doing that, of course, there was a reversal of the trend which they had been working towards. Although, truth to tell, as people would point out, there was still a border in Ireland, but it was nevertheless, because of the success of the peace process, the border was there really only in name only. And I know people would object to my saying that, but it was really in name only. And unfortunately, Brexit was going to change that. So it brought a lot of peripheral discussions and divisions, which were very unpleasant, very difficult. And the result was then later on that when the debate was raging last year, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, took a step politically motivated to try and control the system of debate in Parliament and bring them within guidelines of their own plan for the exit, as it were, because they were to be out by the 31st of October, it was, that they were due to leave. There had been many other dates that had overrun under Theresa May's premiership. But he took a step, which is, we mentioned it in the last chapter, to really to dismantle Parliament, to cause Parliament to cease for a five-day break. And he did this for political motives, to give him time and to stop the matter from being debated in Parliament. There's an old expression that covers that. It's called proroguing, to prorogue Parliament. So in other words, you're calling it to a standstill and the Parliament cannot sit. Many challenges took place, and the first of these took place in Scotland. And indeed, in October 2019, the highest court in Scotland found that it was unlawful and that the attempt to close Parliament was an attempt by the Prime Minister and his government and the Privy Council, who were part of the process there in bringing the document to the Queen of England at her summer residence up in Scotland, flying up to get her to sign this document sanctioning the action. And the group of people would be known as the Privy Councillors. So the Privy Council would be there to advise the Queen on such matters. So the Scottish court found that this was nothing more than an attempt to stifle, wasn't the word they used, they actually said to stymie the operation of Parliament. So unfortunately, because it was a Scottish court, the number 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's headquarters, were in a position not to be in any way affected by that. And they waited, Nobody ever put out a quote that they disregarded the authority of the Scottish judges, but at the same time, it seemed pretty obvious that they weren't too impressed. And as we discussed, I think in the last chapter, little more than a month later, in November, the Supreme Court in the United Kingdom unanimously held that the attempt to do this was unlawful, even going as far as saying that the piece of paper that they brought up to the Queen to sign, that they might have been waving a blank piece of paper at her, that it had no relevance and no authority. So that was an attempt, if you like, to thwart or prevent Parliament from doing its work. And it was an example where the courts overruled that attempt and were seen in many ways as protecting the democratic process. So it was an interesting outturn. At that time, when the Brexit campaign had been raging in the referendum, there were revelations that Facebook and other social media outlets had been actually trying to harvest votes. It's an interesting word, it's rather unpleasant connotations, but that they were advising companies who were looking for information about people's voting trends, their tastes, which would in turn indicate to them whether they were floating votes, as they're called, or people who didn't quite know which way to vote, with a view to capturing them through advertising campaigns pitched towards them deliberately. So people were beginning to realise that a lot had been going on under the radar, and really you could quite confidently say that these allegations, these fears that are being expressed about the algorithms that they call them, the way that the social media technology companies can actually work out algorithms to give more and more refined profiles of us from the data and information that they have about us as to our likely preferences and choices, and therefore moving towards being able to say that we might be able to be identified as a particular kind of voter who would be swayed maybe by a certain kind of pitch of advertising. We also talked in that chapter about data protection and the data protection commissioners, which exist in all of the European countries to protect the information that's held on record by organisations, and the high degree of information protection that has to be administered. We also talked about freedom of information legislation, which is another aspect of giving rights of access to information by citizens, where they can seek to have access to information held by public bodies about them, usually paying a small fee. So they have a right to find out what is recorded in connection with any government or local authority decisions that might be made that would affect them, or information that might be held on record about an individual who would be concerned in some way that that information was incorrect or injurious. We also talked about kind of widening access to justice through these provisions, where the citizen wasn't seen to be locked out, as it were, from information about them or about the movements and the organisation of activity at local government level that might have ultimately have an impact on their lives. So there was a time then when people talked about the need to widen access to justice. And there was a very interesting expression that's often used that said, the law courts of England are as open to every man as the doors of the Ritz Hotel. Well, now the Ritz Hotel, the very expensive hotel, famous hotel in London, and of course the doors would not be open. But the saying, I think, speaks for itself that you could say, well, everybody's allowed to come in here, but not many people would feel that they could without a certain amount of money in their pocket and I suppose, dressed appropriately, to fearful that they might not actually be allowed in. And if they did go in, that they wouldn't be able to afford what the hotel had to offer by way of meals or drinks. So we talked about that in that time, there was a growing interest throughout the world in around the middle 1980s, 90s, and coming up to the 2000s, of finding ways of giving the ordinary citizen an easier, more accessible way of resolving disputes rather than having to go to the expense of going to court. And so the Office of Ombudsman became a very interesting way of providing access to justice for the system. They're very popular offices, with a capital O, in the Nordic lands, and it would be important to say that Sweden claims credit for being the initiator of the concept of the ombudsman, although there's a friendly rivalry between Denmark and Norway and other Nordic countries, Scandinavian countries, who claim that, in fact, Sweden wasn't the first. But the story goes that the King of Sweden, well over 200 years ago, had come up with this idea when he cogitated about what would happen if the ordinary citizen felt that the administration of public bodies, local authorities, other designated functions had fallen below a desirable administrative standard of service to the citizen. And so the idea was born of having an ombudsman. People used to laugh about the word ombudsman and thought incorrectly that it referred to a man, and wondered how women ombudsman officers would deal with that if the office holder was a woman. But of course, it's the generic word. It's a generic meaning. It comes from the Scandinavian ombudsman, which would be the emphasis on the middle part, and it doesn't really mean man. It means an office holder who is, above all question, wholly independent, fair and unbiased in any way, and sits there almost with the same level of importance as a member of a jury, that they would be deemed to be fair and impartial and untouched by anything that could influence them from any of the stakeholders in any debate or dispute. And so the ordinary citizen could refer their case to the ombudsman. Now, in, for example, the United Kingdom and in other countries in the late 1980s, early 1990s, what we had is a growth of ombudsmen, both public sector, local authority ombudsmen, local authority ombudsman for Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland. And then there were the parliamentary ombudsmen in London. And then gradually people saw that these offices worked so well that they became attractive to the private sector. That meant that banking and insurance companies thought that they might set up private sector schemes, as they were called. And they were supposed to follow very carefully the principles of having layers between the people who would have an interest in the outcome of the case, to keep them well separated from the ombudsman, who would be protected by certain parts of the establishment of the office, so that their independence would never be punctured in any way, that nobody could ever put pressure on them, or that no subtle or unsubtle means could be used to influence them in the deliberations of the cases. And so the concept was gaining more respect and credibility. But unfortunately, some of the private sector schemes and private sector interests saw an opportunity, perhaps, to establish such an office with a view to staving off proper regulation from government, and thought slyly in the background, well, we'll get one of these in, and perhaps we can do it our way, and we'll create it in a way that it looks as if it's independent, but indeed we will have an influence over the outcome. And so there was always a risk of that happening. I mentioned yesterday in our discussion about Chapter 8 about Lady Hale, who was then the president of the Supreme Court in London, who was the judge in her capacity as the president of the highest court in England, in the whole of the United Kingdom, correctly to say. And she was, just before she was due to retire, she had this momentous opportunity of reading out the judgment that they made. The 11 judges unanimously decided that it was unlawful to try to suspend Parliament, as the government had attempted to do. She is married to a man called Julian Farrand, who was a professor of law in Manchester University, I think, where they met. And he was an ombudsman twice in the United Kingdom. He was the insurance ombudsman in the early 90s. And then he went on to a very powerful position as a statutory ombudsman for pensions. So he was the pensions ombudsman, which was not a private sector scheme, because it dealt with all of the occupational pension schemes. And he had a very high reputation for being a stalwart in the area of ombudsmanship, if you like, in that he made it very clear that no interference would be tolerated. And he set the bar high at the time when, in the early 90s in the United Kingdom, they set up the UK United Kingdom Ombudsman Association. And in and around 1992, I was appointed as the insurance ombudsman, and word came out that the UK Ombudsman Association was meeting and was forming to consolidate itself into a proper association in London in 1993. And we had our first ombudsman in Ireland, a very impressive man called Michael Mills, and he telephoned me and encouraged me to go along. And so he said it would be very important to be part of that. So there was a big conference in university in the north of England. And at that time, all of the other offices were looking at ways of getting standards set and of trying to consolidate their interests to ensure that ombudsman offices wouldn't be interfered with, even if they were private sector. And this was a gathering of public and private sector. So I went along to that conference. And then the following year, that was in the autumn of 1993, the following year, there was going to be an AGM. And the agenda included at item three, I think it was, that they might consider allowing the Irish ombudsman, of whom there were only three, there was the insurance ombudsman, that was me, the banking ombudsman, a gentleman called Murphy, and Michael Mills, the parliamentary local government ombudsman here. And the three of us were to appear at that AGM, and the minutes for that, or the announcement for the AGM, said that if the proposal carried and we were allowed to become full voting members of the association, we were only associate members up until that time, which was a fairly generous invitation, one would have to say, in the circumstances, and that the name of the association would be changed. So it was the British Ombudsman Association, UK Ombudsman Association, was what it was known as then. So we turned up for that AGM in May 1994, and one of the ombudsmen, Mr. Murphy, missed the plane, didn't arrive, and they took the debate, they took the item, and it was voted, not immediately, but it was voted to admit the Irish ombudsman to become full voting members of the association. And Michael Mills, who was sitting behind me, leant forward, and he was due actually to retire. He knew his retirement was coming up very soon and that he wouldn't be around. And when they decided then that they would change the name of the association to reflect the membership, it became the British and Irish Ombudsman Association, BIOA, an association which I believe was very significant at that time because it was very rare that you would see those words together, British and Irish Ombudsman Association, to be doing something of that nature, that the two identities were linked. And it also gave great opportunity for reciprocal work and exchange of information and for a common purpose and setting standards. And as soon as the votes had been taken, the name had been changed, the secretary said, well, now we are looking for volunteers and we hope that our new Irish members will be energetic at that, volunteering. And they were going to set up a subcommittee to examine standards of best practice for ombudsman offices, which was an extremely important step to take because up until then, as I said, it had become a little bit of free-for-all and lots of people, including Fleet Street and the press, people who might have thought that they would put an ombudsman in for to control it themselves and not the best intentions, were lurking around. And so one had to ensure that the standards were set. And what better place than in an association of this nature, which represented public and private sector ombudsmen. So on that occasion, Michael Mills leaned forward and prodded me in the back and said, put your name forward, because I wouldn't have done so in deference to him in those circumstances, because he knew he wouldn't be around. And sure enough, I volunteered and was asked to join the subcommittee on standards of best practice for ombudsmen. And it was an extremely important time for me because I learnt an enormous amount and could actually use that association, that involvement, as much as I needed in trying to defend any attempt to interfere with my independence. And I had that additional backing, and there were times when it actually proved to be of immense backup and support as a point of reference and also putting people on notice that this is not something you can tamper with or tinker around with or indeed threaten in any way, although that didn't stop people trying. So that was an interesting experience about the expansion of access to justice. And many times one considers that we all owe a great debt of gratitude to that King of Sweden, who felt that it was his endeavour to try and make sure that people had as many opportunities for fair procedures and good administrative practices. That's what an ombudsman really does, is to look at good and fair administration and to call out any acts, any administration, any application of administrative practices and processes that falls below a desirable standard. And the ombudsman ultimately is making a decision on that basis. So it's all about a fair deal, fair treatment and equal treatment. So that's one of the good things about widening access to justice and providing those opportunities for people who don't have to pay. Those services would normally be free, and it leaves people with an opportunity of resolving complaints without having to go the expensive route of heading to court. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you again.